Hello and welcome. My name is Susan Mitchell, and this is the first of my monthly in-depth podcasts on health matters. Given September is Dementia Awareness Month, this first episode is about brain health and dementia, which affects 55,000 people in Ireland. Two leading medical experts in this field are here to discuss the latest studies and innovative treatments for people with dementia. We'll talk about everything from new drugs, diet and exercise to your genetic predisposition to developing dementia. We'll also chat about what we can all do to protect our own brain health as we age. So let me introduce my guests. Professor Sean Kennelly is a consultant geriatrician and the Director of Memory Services at Talla Hospital in Dublin. Dr. Suzanne Timmons is a consultant geriatrician who also has a major national role as a clinical lead for the HSE's National Dementia Office. Thank you both so much for joining me here today. One of the questions that I think both of you must get asked regularly in clinical practice is, how can I prevent dementia? Recent reports have suggested that lifestyle changes can reduce that risk. I read a study in The Lancet that suggested 1 in 3 cases of dementia could be prevented if more people looked after their brain health throughout their life. Is that true? And if so, how do we do that? What does looking after your brain health actually mean? Maybe if we could start with you, Suzanne.
Sure. So I think we're very clear that there are certain risk factors for dementia and they are modifiable or preventable. So smoking, high blood pressure, carrying extra weight, being obese, having diabetes, being physically inactive, and also probably not having used your brain during your life. These are all very well recognised risk factors for dementia. And we're fairly sure that modifying these, so in other words, keeping your blood pressure under control, not smoking, increasing your level of activity, so modifying those risk factors, we're fairly sure reduces the risk of dementia. What we're very sure is it's good for you anyway. It definitely reduces your risk of heart attack and stroke and will help you live longer. So while the evidence for dementia is maybe a little newer and sometimes not as strong, we know this is really good health advice. And so we're very happy to recommend good, healthy lifestyle to protect your brain and to help prevent dementia and to save your life.
Is there much of a genetic predisposition to developing different types of dementia?
So I suppose with, like, you know, many medical conditions, there is a genetic association with certain types of dementia, but it's far from the main contributor towards people developing dementia in later life. There's other factors, as Suzanne mentioned earlier.
And so we would say probably, say for Alzheimer's, which is one type of dementia, when about 1% of people have a strong genetic risk factor, and in fact they're probably 50-50 likely to develop it. But for most of us, 99% of us don't have that, and we might have a small genetic predisposition. We call it a susceptibility, so you're slightly more likely to get it, but a lot of it will depend on so many other things in your lifestyle and in your life. So for a very small number of people, genetics is really important. For most of us, it's a small part of a lot of things that add together.
And yet we're told that many of the risks are non-modifiable. Can you explain that to me? And again, I'm going back to this report that I'd read in The Lancet recently.
So the main risk factor for developing dementia is age. So as we get older, we're more likely to develop dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So 5% of the age is 65 will have Alzheimer's disease, 20% of people by the age of 80 will have Alzheimer's disease, and that goes up to 40% by the age of 90. Despite that age association, what we've begun to see, and this is where the Lancet Commission report came from, we've started seeing reductions in the age-adjusted incidence of developing Alzheimer's disease. So that's what gives us confidence that there is a potentially preventable aspect to this.
Could you just, Sean, run through the age-adjusted? What exactly does that mean?
So that is where we look at, so there's far more people who are growing old. And if we just looked at the raw numbers of people who are developing Alzheimer's disease, as a result of that, there's an increase in the overall number of people who are developing Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And it's going to go from 55,000 to almost 115,000 or so over the next 20, 25 years in Ireland alone. Whereas if you broke it down whereby you looked at it by age, you would start seeing. So the proportion of, so I mentioned there 5% of people at 65, 20% of people at 80, 40% of people at 90. What we're seeing is reductions in those numbers. So despite the fact we've more older people, fewer of those older people are developing Alzheimer's disease. So but the overall numbers are...
Why is that? Why is that?
So, and I suppose it is, it's literally to say that we have so many more older people, but at any age, you're actually slightly less likely now to have dementia than you were. But we just have so many more older people. And that's a good news story. That's advances in public health and hygiene and antibiotics and medicines. And, you know, we must remember this. The reason we've more dementia is actually a good news story. It's because people are living longer and people are expected now to be living into their hundreds. So this is a good news story, but a side effect is more dementia.
But yet, as you said there, Sean, there are fewer people relative to the size of the population or to different age groups actually going on to develop dementia. Why is that? Do we know?
So probably the main impact over the last 20, 30 years. So the most of this evidence is coming from where we have registers. And that's one of our difficulties and one of our challenges in Ireland is we don't have a patient register or we don't have a register of people with dementia. But in countries like the US, Sweden, Germany, the UK, who have had dementia registers for a long time, that's where anybody who's diagnosed with dementia goes on a national register. What we found is those numbers are declining overall. The overall numbers are increasing, but when you adjust them for the numbers of older people, there's fewer of them. And it's likely due to blood pressure control. It's likely due to diabetes control, cholesterol control, and those kind of vascular risk factors in particular.
So health modifications as such that people are getting more of. There are various different types of dementia. There's Alzheimer's disease, which I believe is the most common, vascular dementia, dementia from Parkinson's, dementia with Lewy bodies and frontotemporal dementia. I probably haven't even got them all there, but can you identify or tell us what causes dementia and is it different for the different types? Does it depend on the type?
Well, would I start? Actually, there's 400 different causes of dementia. So it's
wow. So we're never going to get through them in
we'll start now with number one. But the Alzheimer's, as you said, is the most common. It's about 2/3. And that, like a lot of dementias, are caused by a buildup of proteins. So normal proteins that are in your brain start to clump together and build up either in cells or outside them, and they interfere with how your brain cells work. And eventually they'll cause your brain cells to die. So Alzheimer's is due to two particular abnormal proteins. Parkinson's is due to a different abnormal protein. Frontotemporal is due to a different one. So protein buildup is the most common cause of dementia, and it, especially the most common ones.
And do we know, Suzanne, what causes this buildup of protein?
So for a very small number of people, it's a strong genetic predisposition. They have, for example, in Alzheimer's, there's two proteins, amyloid and tau. And some people have an abnormal form of amyloid that naturally will tend to form clumps. And for the rest of us, it's a combination of factors. So it's lifestyle factors. It's poor blood supply to your brain cells getting damaged and starting to handle these proteins differently. The energy powerhouses of the cells handling these protein differently. So it's a combination of a lot of factors start to cause the protein buildup, and then you get into a vicious cycle. And the more protein that builds up, the more cells get damaged, the more they start to get killed, everything starts to cycle very quickly then.
I think it's important to also point out these proteins start accumulating in the brain 25 years before you have any symptoms of memory loss. So somebody in their 30s and 40s is starting to accumulate these, if you like, damaging proteins within their brain. And that's why, you know, in some respects that can be daunting, but it gives us a huge window of opportunity to intervene and actually prevent the downstream effects.
And could I also say, sure, we talked about the protein buildup, and I think overall that's the most common cause of dementia, but poor blood supply to the brain is the other really common cause. So no matter if your destiny is to build up a particular protein and to eventually develop dementia, if on top of that you smoke and you have high blood pressure or you drink excessively and you're damaging your brain cells through other mechanisms, then they're going to succumb to that protein much quicker, and it's going to happen much faster that the proteins build up. So poor blood supply is a cause in its own right of dementia. We call that vascular dementia, but it also accelerates any other type of dementia. So protein is a big chunk of it. Poor blood supply is another. And then inflammation, how the brain reacts to proteins, infections, toxins. There's lots of other causes.
Could I ask you, Sean, what is mild cognitive impairment?
So mild cognitive impairment is whereby you have memory symptoms where when we objectively measure them on a test. So the test that we use to measure memory, we compare the scores, your scores, to other people your age and your education level who've done the test previously. And we rank you according to their performance. And what mild cognitive impairment is where objectively when we look at your memory scores on a test, we're able to see that you're performing at least what we call one standard deviation. So significantly worse than your peers. But by the same token, you have no functional impairment. So you don't have a memory problem. So your nuisance is probably more objectively measured via a test. That's what mild cognitive impairment. It's a bit of an arbitrary diagnosis. And certainly it doesn't mean that somebody with mild cognitive impairment. So if we just take the diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, only about 40% of them, if you have one type of mild cognitive impairment, 40% of them will go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. But if you have another type of mild cognitive impairment, which isn't, let's say, memory or recall related, only 15 or 16% will go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. So mild cognitive impairment isn't like pre-diabetes or somebody with non-specific, mildly elevated intermittent high blood pressure. It doesn't mean that you're potentially invariably going to go on to develop a more significant condition, which is why we follow people with mild cognitive impairment for a few years in the clinic, just to make sure that everything has stabilized. And also if your mood is low, if you're stressed, of course people are going to have poor performance in those tests. So those tests, people who come to the clinic are always really, really worried about doing the memory tests. And we always reassure them that it is the least important piece of the information. The story that they tell us and how their memory difficulty is impacting on their life is way more important than anything that we see objectively in those tests. They guide us along. There's no point, we do them because they're important, but they're not the be all and end all.
I agree. It's a cognitive test is it's of use to us, but it's not the whole picture. And I think it's important for people to have, at some stage to have their memory checked and to have an idea of what their normal is. That can be really useful, because particularly in a hospital, when someone's very sick, their memory can often take a big dip, and it's useful to have an idea. So not to be afraid of a memory test, but everyone scores differently, and some people have a lot of performance anxiety and will score really badly on a memory test, and yet everyone around them will say, well, actually, in day-to-day terms, you've no memory trouble, and that's useful to know as well. So I think Sean has explained well. Really, mild cognitive impairment it's kind of a halfway house between having subjective memory trouble or memory nuisance, as we talked about, and dementia, which is where your memory problem is to a degree that it impacts on your ability to do day-to-day life.
And tell me, when someone is diagnosed or given a diagnosis of dementia, very often, they're prescribed different types of medication. But as I understand it, the medication that is currently on the market is pretty old and not all that impressive. And by that, I mean that they don't actually slow the progression of the disease. Am I right in that? And if so, what do they do?
So we currently have four agents licensed for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. The last one that was licensed in 2002. They're largely symptomatic treatments in that they may help and have a very modest benefit with regards to symptoms of maybe memory and judgment. They were studied within robust clinical trials, but by the expectation of what we'd hope, they don't alter the course of the disease. So they don't make it less likely that your memory symptoms are going to progress. They don't stop the Alzheimer's disease progressing, but for a group of people, they may offer some symptomatic benefit. They're also relatively well tolerated, but there are some side effects with it. So generally speaking, we would prescribe them, but with little expectation that they're going to make a significant impact.
And Arthur, I sometimes read about drug trials, and it's more on the oncology side, where you read about so-called super responders. Do you see super responders for some of the agents that you have at your disposal or that you can prescribe for patients that may come into your clinics?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting point. Within an oncology setting, I suppose you're looking at scans and you're looking at the size of tumours and you're looking at something that's very objectively identified. Within the context of memory, I suppose you're still dealing on an awful lot of subjectivity, in that you're talking about how somebody perceives their symptoms and how you subjectively interpret what they're telling you about their symptoms. Often the super responders that I would see in clinic are people who may have been depressed and who may have had other things going on. And as well as starting them on this medicine, as well as the relief they get from a diagnosis, what happens is their mood improves, their overall level of social engagement improves, and that's what causes the super response. But, you know, to be honest, there's very few people that you could say are super responders specifically to these agents.
Could I add to that and say, actually, I think that's a really important point. You know, how anyone would perform on a test of their memory or their brain function, their cognitive test, would really be variable day to day. We all have days where we're pumped and we're ready to do it, and everything works in our favour. And so if you're testing a response is how you do on a memory test that asks you 30 questions, there's going to be a lot of natural variability. And the reason I say this, it's important for people not to get too hung up sometimes on their test result. We're always interested in long-term trends, and you know, everyone is different to begin with, so sometimes people can get very focused on how am I going to do and get very stressed about performing, and we look at a lot more than just a result in a paper test.
The performance that I'm interested in is your performance at home, your performance when you're working. So the most important, you know, far more important than the neuropsychological testing or the tests, the memory tests we do, is the story that you and your carer give.
As to how people are functioning,
how people are progressing, and as to the diagnosis in its own right. And that's what makes it, I suppose, a challenging diagnosis, is that you need to have the time and you need to have the skill and expertise to interpret that story that's been told you. That's still the main foundation of the diagnosis.
And obviously, we don't have a cure. We don't have a drug that can slow the progression of the disease. Is there any hope? Is there any hope that we might have one within the next 5 or 10 years, or any seriously positive drugs in development? I might ask you that, Sean.
Yeah. So I think there's several reasons to be optimistic. One is that the G8 have highlighted it as their primary area of, you know, of concern, and they're you know, placing a lot of resources in trying to identify and develop new treatments. So there's way more resource going in to try and develop a treatment for Alzheimer's disease than ever before. Our understanding of the science as to what causes Alzheimer's disease and how these proteins, you asked earlier, how do we accumulate those proteins? That's evolved a huge amount over the last, you know, decade in particular. And year on year, we understand an awful lot more. That's meant that we're in a position to perhaps develop agents that we wouldn't have even been able to anticipate or envisage. Looking at ways that we can use our immune system. So Suzanne mentioned about inflammation within the brain. So how we can use our own immune system to target these proteins. That's probably the avenue of most optimism, and there's several agents coming through that use that, you know, method to try and treat Alzheimer's disease. But in reality, if one of these trials were positive today, so if there was, it would still probably take 3 to 5 years to translate it into the clinical practice, and we have to work on making that quicker, so to get it to people who need it sooner. And then also our services that we have in place for helping us identify who would specifically benefit, because it's likely the future treatment for Alzheimer's disease may not be too dissimilar from our treatment for cancer now, whereby you have specialists who give lots of different types of, you know, chemotherapy target depending on the type of tumor you have. So depending on the type of dementia you have, depending on the type of proteins you have, you may be more suitable for one of these treatments than another. So we need to develop services that'll be able to respond to that. But in reality, we're still, you know, several years away from having a definitive treatment that'll be available for patients. But there is good cause to be optimistic with regards to potential to develop that. But I'm sure Suzanne might mention that we still shouldn't lose track of the need for the majority of patients, which will be social care.
Absolutely. And I think this is it. It's not to put all your eggs in one basket. Mm. There is a huge amount of research, and including Ireland. It's fantastic how much Ireland sometimes is leading the world on understanding more about dementia. And that leads to a potential treatment, which has to go through all these stages. And there's lots of different drugs being looked at the moment. And there's, you know, that gives us great hope. At the same time, prevention, people keeping their brains healthy, is really important, because you may not stop somebody getting dementia, but if you can delay it for 5 or 10 years, that can make a huge difference to someone's life, being diagnosed with dementia at 90 as opposed to 80, or at 80 as opposed to 70. And then, as John said, you know, we mustn't lose sight of the people who still have dementia or will have dementia in 5 years' time. Even if there is a cure at that stage, it may be too late for them. So we have to work across a lot of different domains at the same time, improving our care, looking to cure, looking to prevent and to delay.
You mentioned there, Suzanne, about keeping our brains healthy, and that was something I was going to ask you both about. I've read lectures given by neuroscientists and watched them talk about the need to stimulate our brains and to take on new challenges and do new things that we can actually help to build up. And I'm talking about for healthy adults and possibly even those who have been diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, or I think that's mild memory loss. Is there much evidence to support that? And at what stage or what point do you recommend that adults begin to start thinking about doing these things?
So the best health policy ever and always has been an education policy. So if you look at it, so you said, when do we start? So you start from the day you're born, and actually investment in education. So if you take the Tilda cohort at the moment, that's the longitudinal study on aging that's going on here in Ireland. And you look at, they're all over the age of 55, and about 50% of them completed second level education.
And sorry, who's running this
so
study then?
That's run by Roseanne Kenny and Trinity College Dublin. And this is where they've taken 8,000 people who are 55 years and older, and they're following them forward to see what are the risk factors, what are the things they're doing correctly that ensures positive aging, and the things that maybe are happening that causes challenges for them later in life. But if you look at that cohort, about 50% of them completed second level education. If you look at the figures from the Department of Education from 2 or 3 years ago, 96-97% of young boys and girls are now completing second level education. That's developing a thing called, you know, cognitive reserve. And it, you know, where we see the impact of that is later on in life when people are developing dementia. And we know between low education, so between only having 10 to 12 years of education versus having 15 to 16 years of education, there's about a 40% reduction in your risk of developing dementia.
40%?
40%. Depending on your occupation, then it goes forward into life. Then, depending
on your occupation. So, tell me what occupations out of interest.
So what they've done is they've looked at, and these are true meta-analysis. So, these aren't individual studies. This is where we group studies from studies like Tilda. If you look at complexity of working, so if you have a low complexity job versus a higher complexity job. So, let's say in particular, if you're in a managerial role where you're directing other people. Yet again, it comes true as 40% risk reduction. So there's a protective effect of having a more complex job later in life. So the question is how do you socially influence things at that stage of life? And then if you haven't had the benefit of those things,
yes.
I think this is where Suzanne's going to get
to.
What do you do when you're a little bit older and you haven't had maybe the full benefit
because
of those
things? Because the important thing is, you know, some people have different jobs. If you worked in a job that you weren't using your brain a lot, it was more of a physical job, don't despair, you know.
Okay.
So still do a job that you like and that, you know, that pays well as well, hopefully. But it's very important for people, if they're not using their brain a lot at work, to see how can they use it more in their leisure. And I suppose a lot of people focus on doing crosswords and Sudoku, and they're important, but there's a lot of other ways to use your brain. And actually, we know that social memory is really important. So that's when you meet people, taking the time to remember, oh, is it your granddaughter's communion next week? And what was her name again? So it's often that social memory and social connectiveness, staying active in your community. So when you do retire, making sure you've hobbies that you like doing and that keep you meeting people. So it doesn't always have to be a solitary doing a computer brain game or doing a crossword. You get just as much benefit from your memory of meeting people and remembering things about people and playing card games together.
And what about taking on new challenges? For example, learning a language or deciding to learn the piano at the age of 50 or 60. Is there much evidence to support that type of
So that's
initiative?
What we think. We think lifelong learning is really important. That learning that you continue to do. So a lot of us probably do most of our learning when we're younger, and then sometimes you can get into a job where, you know, you can do it in your sleep after a few years. And that's where you need to say, well, what will I do now? And a second language is a fantastic example, or learning an instrument, because that's a really different skill. So my best advice to people would be to try to challenge your brain in a lot of different ways. So rather than just focusing on crosswords, mix up crosswords with playing an instrument, the more ways you challenge your brain, the different types of skills you make it learn, the stronger it becomes overall.
And I presume as well that, you know, even if you have a job that is more intellectually challenging than someone else might, you can still benefit from all of these other initiatives. So the more you do that, the better off you are. Is that the
absolutely
reality?
But I think if you, you know, you might then suffer from having a job that's quite sedentary, or maybe that's quite stressful. So maybe your focus then would be in your downtime getting more physical activity and making sure that you're de-stressing. So mindfulness, meditation. So I think all of us should look at what we're getting from our job and what we're not getting from our job. And then in your spare time, in your social life, in your retirement, maybe trying to swing the pendulum a little bit towards other things.
And a lot of people listening to this will be interested in where they're transitioning from their first life to their second life. And a lot of people...
You mean into retirement?
Yes, into retirement. And that's become the common phrase now, is, you know, your second life. And perhaps one of the main reasons, so we see a huge amount of people presenting to memory clinics around about that transition, whereby they've gone from a huge amount, you know, an awful lot of engagement, having lots to do for a day, and then they're very worried when their memory starts slipping, because 2 or 3 years later, you know, they're not maybe able to remember things as well as they were beforehand. That doesn't mean that you have a significant memory difficulty, but it probably should be a stimulus to think that, okay, you need to find different means of filling your day to what you did beforehand. And that I usually tell people their second job now is actually trying to find those social engagements, those opportunities for physical activity, social activity, that beforehand, the time that they used to give to working.
What is the difference, Sean? You mentioned there are people, you know, who have just recently retired who begin to notice they're maybe not as sharp or their memory isn't working as well as it might have when they were in full-time employment. What is the difference between memory nuisance and a memory problem? And how do you, as an expert in this area, determine or differentiate between the two?
So memory nuisance can happen to us at any stage of life. You know, it's really where we become forgetful. It's the going upstairs, I can't remember what I went upstairs for. It's misplacing things. But when you look, you're able to find them afterwards. It's not being able to think of somebody's name when you immediately want to think, or having difficulty placing the exact context. All of us can identify with that, and it happens to us regularly. The more tired we are, if we're a bit unwell, if our mood is a little bit low, memory nuisance tends to happen more often. What a memory problem is whereby, as a result of recurring memory symptoms, you're not able to do your day-to-day tasks as well as you were able to do them before. And in fact, that's how we define dementia. Dementia is defined as a clinical syndrome on the basis of you not being able to perform your day-to-day tasks, such as maybe it's your finances. If you're still working, it may be your work. If it's, you know, house chores at home or organizing things. So you lose that ability as a result of your memory. That's where dementia, and that's what I would call a memory problem.
And we've spoken a lot of, you know, about brain health for relatively healthy adults. Could you tell us what's important for people who have received a diagnosis of dementia? I've read a little bit about cognitive stimulation. Suzanne, how important, well, first of all, what is that? What is cognitive stimulation? And how easy is it for people to access supports in Ireland right now?
The first thing to say is that everything we talked about in keeping your brain healthy continues to be important when you have mild cognitive impairment or dementia. So your blood pressure, not smoking, etc., etc. But in addition to that, cognitive stimulation is where you're exercising the brain. So we're all familiar with exercising our bodies, and this is where you begin to exercise the brain. So it's usually done in a group setting. So people who have mild cognitive impairment or mild to moderate dementia come together as a group, and they do some exercises to try to improve their memory, word games, games that involve remembering numbers and things like that. Maybe some reorientation, remembering what day it is, what's the name of everyone else that's at the group. Sometimes it can be things like baking, you know, or cooking, because there's a lot of sequencing in that. So it's performed in a short burst, maybe 6 or 7 weeks, twice a week. People come together and they exercise their brain. And that's cognitive stimulation. And then linked to that, cognitive rehabilitation is where you're not exercising your brain to try to improve your memory. You're trying to adapt to the memory problems you have. And that's working with people to write things down, to use mnemonics to remind them of things, to learn how to remember somebody's name when you meet them by a trick. And that's very important as well. And there's actually quite good evidence to show that cognitive stimulation and cognitive rehabilitation work well. In fact, they probably work better than the medications we're currently using, which Sean talked about earlier.
And is there widespread availability of these classes that you mentioned? Is this something that most people who receive a diagnosis can access right now in their local community?
So a few years ago, I would have said no, that it was actually quite challenging. But I suppose one piece of good news is the National Dementia Office ran a competition, you could say, for every region of Ireland to propose new classes for cognitive stimulation therapy or cognitive rehab or what we would call psychoeducational classes. And so there's going to be two in each region. So a region would be like Donegal and Mayo together, or Cork and Kerry together. And so that's under review at the moment, and those results are going to be announced after the summer. So we're going to see much more resources available. If someone has memory trouble, mild cognitive impairment or dementia, and they're interested, their first port of call is always their own GP or public health nurse. If they are attending a memory clinic, they let them know if that service is already available in their region. At the moment, it would be variable nationally, but as I said, within the next year, I hope it'll be much more widely available.
Sorry, go ahead, Sean.
I was going to say, I mean, it's very timely to bring up the issue of services, because one of the big issues we have in Ireland is a complete inequity with regards to access to memory diagnostic services. So if you're living west of the Shannon, you've access to very few services whereby you're going to be able to get a specialist diagnosis. Whereas if you live in Dublin, you have a choice of several. If you live in Cork, you also have the choice of several expert centres whereby you can go to. But we don't have it's one of the key things we need to address over the next few years is how we give more access to people, especially because, you know, 15 years ago, when I started working in memory clinics, the majority of people were older. And actually now there's a large chunk, about 20% of the people who are coming into the memory clinic are under the age of 65 with memory symptoms. There's far more, you know, challenges and nuance in trying to diagnose and advise people who are still working who are younger, you know, with regards how they might progress with their memory symptoms versus, you know, even that older cohort where maybe sometimes the diagnosis is a little bit easier. So we have a huge challenge in trying to establish and clearly lay out an equity for access to memory services across the country.
And can I ask you both about the benefit of exercise and indeed food or supplements? I read a recent report showing or suggesting that fish oils, which we've all been told for years, if not decades, were in fact not all that beneficial for our or for our hearts. Is there anything to suggest that certain types of food or indeed exercise can benefit people with a diagnosis of dementia?
Well, I would say that we don't know for definite at the moment. There is really good evidence that people have probably heard of the Mediterranean type diet. So that's a diet that has a lot of fruit and vegetables, not so much red meat, fish, olive oil. That people who have that type of diet have lower rates of dementia. However, what we're not sure at the moment is that their diet or is there something else about these people? So in other words, the type of people who follow this diet are a little different. So there's really good evidence that following this diet seems to be linked to lower rates of dementia. And there's some provisional promising results from studies where they wouldn't have been looking specifically at dementia. They would have been looking more at heart disease and stroke, but they did check people's memories and they certainly seemed to be better on people who in a study were advised to follow the diet. And then there's one, I suppose the groundbreaking study was the finger study in Finland, where they incorporated exercise and diet and information about keeping your blood vessels healthy. And in that study, they showed rates of dementia were lower in people who did these together. So while diet is important, it may not be enough on its own. You may have to combine it with exercise. We need more studies. But we know that Mediterranean diet is really good for your blood vessels. It prevents heart attack and strokes. And I'd have no hesitation in recommending to anyone to follow that type of diet. Well, the degree of difference it makes to your risk of dementia, we don't quite know yet. And I think the next few years, there's going to be many more of those type of what we call multi-component studies. So in another year or two, we'll know the answer. But for your general health and for, as I said, keeping you alive, there's no doubt that's the type of diet we should should be advocating.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, if you can imagine, the challenge in trying to do preventative studies is how long do you follow somebody up for? So how long do you track somebody to see that you've prevented it? Because you didn't know to begin that they were going to develop it. So you take high risk groups, but being at high risk doesn't mean you're inevitably going to develop it. So
they're very complex studies.
So they're very complex studies that may need to run for quite a few times. So there's studies ongoing, which as they run longer, we may see more promising effects. So that's why we lean on population studies like TILDA for information. And you mentioned fish oil. So certainly, I think it becomes difficult to break it down into one thing or another thing. But if you looked at, there's been now 7 or 8 studies that have looked at consumption of fish. And if you're eating fish once or twice a week, and the magic number 40%, but believe it or not, you're 40% less likely to develop dementia later in life. So fish certainly has an effect, and it's because
Sorry,
of this
omega. If you're omega eating, just to recap there, if you eat fish
once to twice a week,
you have a 40% lower.
Lower
well,
risk of developing.
Let's be clear. The people who, the type of person who eats fish are people who eat fish. What we're not sure is, what else is it about the type of person who eats fish or doesn't eat fish is the question.
I'm slightly more optimistic because actually we control for that in population studies. So we control for your socioeconomic background, we control for your gender, your age, and all of those factors within a population study. What we don't do though in a population study like TILDA is say, right, we're going to give you fish and we're not going to give you fish and we're going to see what happens. So we don't have that scientific rigor. But what we can do is make general observations with regards. And I think...
And Suzanne, just to clarify there, would you feel it's as high as 40%, that it's as significant as that?
So the thing about a 40% reduction, it sounds great, but just to say that...
I'm about to go to my local fishmonger after this.
But if your risk of dementia was 10%, that brings it down to 6%. So it's not a fourfold reduction, it's a 40% reduction. And I hope I haven't come across over negative. I would also agree people should be eating fish. However, we just need to be careful with studies where they looked at a population who did A or B and they looked at a population who didn't. Even though they matched them for all the important things they can, there might still be differences in those people. The only way to prove it is to do a study. And in the study, some people eat lots of fish and some people don't. And that's where we need more research proving that. So you can have a really strong... idea that something works, but if you really want to prove it, you need to do the big studies.
Absolutely. I suppose the science for it comes though. So omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, the main source of which is fish. We don't have an indigenous source within our bodies. It's the main nutrient for brain cells. So fish is the main means by which you get it. So there's a logic that eating more fish kind of builds into that brain reserve. So we talked about cognitive reserve. Brain reserve is the size of the brain, the number of nerves you have, and the number of synapses, which are the connections between the brain. And we know that people who have more omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids have generally healthier brains.
And you're talking about, just to be clear as well, you're talking about fish as opposed to fish supplements.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
And could I say the same probably for vitamins as well? People get very hung up on vitamin E and B vitamins. And there's been studies looking at whether taking these as supplements can help your memory and prevent dementia. And I think it's very important to differentiate that from taking fresh fruit and vegetables, and particularly fresh vegetables. There are so many health benefits from vegetables and lots of studies.
And this is where you'll be getting your vitamin B, is it, that you're talking about?
Exactly, because you get lots of vitamin B and folate in fresh vegetables. I would be worried that somebody would have quite a poor diet and eat a lot of processed foods and, you know, very little fibre and think that they can take a multivitamin and somehow it's all great. It is not the same. You get so many extra health benefits from fibre in your bowel, preventing bowel cancer, and we know that that roughage in your bowel, so that's fresh fruit and vegetable, helps the bacteria in your bowel, and that's really important, and that's a very up and coming area. How much does that help your brain? So it's always better to get your vitamins and your fish oils through the food as opposed to through supplements.
In other words, the real deal.
And I think, I mean, you always have to strike a balance, because in the end of the day, we're kind of giving opinion on research, and two people will read research and they might come with different conclusions. Some, you know, there's a glass half full and a glass half empty, you know, approach towards these things. And that's the basis for a good, solid exploration of the research. I think what we could probably both agree on is also red meat. We eat too much red meat, and red meat is certainly, when eaten in high quantities, and many people would eat it several times a week here, the advice would be that you should only eat it at most a couple of times a month. So too much red meat. And what I try and advise people is swap out red meat every so often for fish. So where you're thinking you're going to get a big fillet steak, go get a cod steak. And there's certainly enough evidence to support doing that for both your heart and your brain.
And I'd fully agree. And could I also say alcohol? I think we focus so much on diet and we forget alcohol is a neurotoxin. It poisons your brain. And, you know, so maybe you don't like fish and maybe you'll struggle a little bit with fish, but don't forget that you need to watch your alcohol. So we have recommended limits for alcohol. So men shouldn't be drinking more than 17 standard units, they say, a week, and women just 11 standard units a week, which is a very small glass of wine. And don't forget about that, because alcohol, particularly in Ireland, is a major contributor to dementia. And, you know, we know alcohol.
Do we know it's actually a contributor?
Well, it does. So there is a particular form of dementia that only alcoholics get called Korsakoff's dementia, which is where the alcohol stops them absorbing thiamine and they get dementia. People who have heavy alcohol intake are at higher risk. People who drink moderately are actually at lower risk. So we think a small amount of alcohol might be protective. But I would never say to someone, start drinking if you don't. What we definitely know is heavy alcohol drinking damages brain cells.
Even outside of being a direct contributor to that type of dementia that you mentioned, is it a contributor to the other? So, for example, is it a contributor to Alzheimer's disease,
yes,
which is the most prevalent one?
It's a contributor towards the expression of it. So about 10% of young cases and early, if you like, younger, older cases of Alzheimer's disease, alcohol is a significant contributor. Because if you can imagine, it's an extra toxin. So when we drank at the age of 20, we weren't in our best form of judgment and we weren't making big decisions. Okay, it impaired our judgment, it impaired our memory, and our recollection of what happened the night before wasn't great. So if you take a brain that's already vulnerable as a result of these proteins that are there and you drink, well, naturally enough, you're doing further damage and you're exacerbating the symptoms due to that, because your brain's capacity to adapt is limited by the fact that you have alcohol on board, which is also exacerbating it. And then also as a result of certain types of dementia, people start drinking and consume more because the parts of the brain that tell them to drink less, they're less able to control their actions, and it feeds into it in that way as well. And so in particular, what we call frontal areas, which are responsible for our decision making and some of our behaviours, when they get impaired by dementia or by mild dementia, we tend to drink. We have a tendency where, you know, somebody who drinks may drink more and not be checking themselves as much as they would have beforehand. So Suzanne's absolutely right. It's a very, very important.
So the more ways you damage your brain, the earlier you're going to present with dementia. So if your destiny is to build up amyloid and tau protein and have Alzheimer's, the difference between that affecting you being able to live your life at 70 could be, do you also smoke? Are you also diabetic? Do you also drink heavily? And making those changes, even though your destiny is still, unfortunately, to develop Alzheimer's, you will not start to be affected by it for maybe another 10 years. So, you know, that's where we talked about these modifiable and non-modifiable. So rather than anyone getting totally hung up on particular elements of diet and how many berries should I eat a day, and as I say, should I eat a bucket of walnuts, sometimes people can focus on a particular food group and to extremes. It's a good, healthy, fresh fruit and vegetables, low red meat diet with fish and with nuts and seeds and other sources of protein other than red meat, and watch your alcohol consumption and do not smoke. You know, imagine if you were following all the right diet but continuing to smoke heavily.
What about exercise?
So, I mean, exercise is tremendously important, and there's been an awful lot of research over the last few years looking at the impact of exercise on the brain. It's mostly conclusive. I think there's enough that we could definitely recommend that activity. So it depends, you know, it's how you define exercise versus activity, okay? Remaining active is very important. And by activity, we mean exercising for 30 minutes 5 days a week. Okay, and you should be, you know, out of breath enough that you're not able to have a full conversation, but still able to chat to somebody you're walking alongside. So it's not a leisurely romantic stroll.
So it's not, and I'm very interested in this particular point because I have this debate with my own father regularly, who assures me that light gardening is his form of exercise. That doesn't work, does it not, Sean?
Domestic, sure. And there's two reasons for that. One is it has to be purposeful. So it has to be protected time that you set aside to do something. Exercising is also the time that our brain, so there's two times that our brain decides what it's going to retain and what it's going to dump. as in from the point of view of memory. So if you take short-term memory, is in particular the memory that's impacted by many types of dementia, in particular Alzheimer's disease, in a year's time, I won't need to remember that I needed to stop off in the shop and get a litre of milk and a loaf of bread on the way home. Okay, but I might like to remember that I've done this interview and we've had this chat today. So later on tonight, when I'm asleep, my brain will decide, actually, I'm going to remove that memory, I'm going to erase that memory, but actually I'm going to keep this one. And the two times that the brain does that is when we sleep, and that's why we haven't mentioned sleep, but sleep is becoming clear as a really important predictor and risk factor for developing dementia. And the other time is exercising. So when we're exercising or doing dedicated exercise is probably the other time that our brain decides on retention of important memories. There's a really interesting study that came out last year on Swedish women, where they measured, they took almost 2,000 women back in 1968, and they did really detailed basic fitness levels. So it wasn't just exercise, how much are you active? Usually we do this by questionnaires. What they did is they brought them in on, you know, the treadmills, and they really...
So they gave them physical tests as such.
And they measured specifically what their exercise and their fitness levels were at. And then they compared recently, if you like, the outcomes from the point of view of dementia on those that had good fitness levels versus bad fitness levels. The people who had high fitness levels in midlife, as they were then, were 90% less likely to develop dementia. It was a colossal impact. Now, they only had 200 people that they were able to follow, but that's probably the most interesting and specific, and it was just women. There's loads of caveats to the study, but it was very, very strong. For those people who developed dementia, high versus low fitness levels, you were 9 years later. Okay, so if you were going to develop dementia, it was 9 years later that you developed it. So there was a really strong message that fitness in midlife has massive dividends for later in life.
And do these, we've spoken a lot about nutrition, exercise, alcohol. Do these rules also pertain to people who have already received a diagnosis of dementia? Is there any evidence to suggest that if you or your loved one, if you're caring for someone who has received a diagnosis, that following the diet that you spoke a lot about, Suzanne, this Mediterranean diet, you know, trying to get good rest, sleep, exercising, will it improve your symptoms? Will it possibly slow the progression of the disease?
I think there's no reason to think it won't continue to work. However, as you would get into more advanced stages of dementia, a lot of times the damage, the vicious cycles are already set up in your brain. So I think it's much more important for people to focus on prevention. So exactly as Sean has said, a healthy lifestyle choices you make in your 40s and your 50s is actually the time to be making them, not waiting till your 70s or 80s. But if you are already in your 70s or 80s, yes, it's never too late to make changes. And if you have mild cognitive impairment or dementia, the exact same type of lifestyle choices will, the proteins will still be building up, but how healthy your brain cells are and remain will make a big difference. So if you don't get a small stroke, you will continue to function very well, even though a certain amount of protein is there. If on top of that you get a stroke, suddenly everything has changed. So it doesn't stop working up to the point where somebody, as I said, has severe memory trouble. And often then our focus will change more on actually good nutrition to build up body weight and build up protein. And so the advice might change a little.
And I think stress, you know, can be a significant thing that promotes or worsens symptoms of dementia. And it can be a huge source of stress, because remember, it takes quite a bit of understanding at an individual level to say, right, and commitment to say, right, I'm going to change my diet, right, I'm going to be active. And that level of understanding and commitment may not be possible for somebody even with moderate stages of dementia, in which case you may have a carer who's kind of trying to coerce and bring somebody along towards eating a diet that the person with dementia doesn't want to eat, doing activities the person with dementia doesn't want, and it causes stress at home, which actually then contributes a huge amount to care stress and then to stress for the person with dementia, which actually probably worsens their symptoms overall. Okay. So I think
it can be counterproductive,
exactly,
in other words, if they're not.
A fine balance
this
is it,
and you have to be practical. And could I just take this point to say that if anyone is interested, because we've talked about a lot, that there are great resources available, and particularly the Understand Together website, so it's understandtogether.ie, has a whole section on it on brain health, and it has some very user-friendly videos and everything which will talk about what we've talked about and other things. If anyone is worried about their memory, or, you know, wants to protect their future memory, or has been diagnosed with memory problem and wants more advice, it's a really a one-stop shop.
And so, this is a website that's run by the HSE, is that right, Suzanne?
That's right. So, and it's run in conjunction with the Alzheimer's Society, but it has been set up to be a single website that you should be able to find out everything you need to know.
Because I think that can be a problem, can't it? There is a lot of misunderstanding out there, and in some cases, some misinformation out there. Are there any other bits of advice that you give people, Sean, in respect of that?
Yeah, no, I think the main thing is go towards the website. So most memory services will direct you, most GPs will be aware of the websites that have up-to-date and reliable information, and that aren't, you know, so some websites and some information on the internet is put there for marketing purposes where people are trying to sell multivitamins or things like that. So I think it is to, you know, that people are careful when they're looking online for information that they're going to trusted sites like the Understand Together site or the Alzheimer's Society site as well. We've had a really, you know, broad conversation, and it just struck me that there is one other aspect that we haven't mentioned, which is hearing. And for people with mild dementia and for people at risk of developing dementia, that was the main thing that came through in the Lancet Commission that you mentioned right at the beginning, that actually we probably hadn't realised or appreciated fully before. So in midlife, if you have a mild hearing difficulty, you're probably twice as likely to develop a memory difficulty later in life.
Is that because you withdraw socially, or do we know why that
So that was one of the key pieces that they highlighted, is we don't actually have a huge amount of information. There's probably two reasons. One is we have a difficulty in taking the information in. So when we were remembering something, there's kind of three steps that go into it. You have to take it in the first place, which is where our attention, our concentration, and our ability to process information. So hearing would be important for that. Then it has to go into the right part of the brain, be stored in that right part of the brain. And it's only if those first two bits happen that we can recall it later on. So actually the first two bits are really important. And things like stroke and mood and all of those other factors we talked about, are alcohol, in fact, you know, they really affect those first two parts. Hearing, the other thing that may be evident in hearing is the brain is like a fuse board, you know, so in that different parts of the brain are responsible for different functions. So you have the fuse for the sockets in the kitchen, you have a part of the brain that's responsible for short-term memory. You have a fuse for the lights in the kitchen, you have a part of the brain that's responsible for understanding what we're hearing. So we don't hear with our ears or see with our eyes, we see with our brain and we hear with our brain. All of the you know, the outward parts, you know, parts are just receptacles. So that, you know, so if somebody having a hearing deficit may actually be an early symptom or an early sign that maybe there might be an evolving memory difficulty. So that's also how it might play into it. But certainly what we understand is that, you know, people who have a hearing difficulty are at higher risk, and actually it is correctable for a lot of people. So, and I meet people all the time in clinic who complain to me for 10 years that they have, you know, difficulty with hearing and have never gone to have it checked out.
And I suppose that plays into that thing of social memory. If you're not hearing people properly, and if you are avoiding social and group events, you're losing that workout of your brain in remembering the details about Mary and where did she go on her holiday last week. And so I think Sean is exactly right. A few years ago, we weren't talking about hearing loss and deafness. And in a way, I think it was always there in front of our eyes. We always knew that people in the hospital, for example, who couldn't hear well, you know, were very at risk of getting confused and things like that. And, you know, now we're much more proactive in it. And I would say to a little degree, probably the same for poor vision. You know, everyone with a medical card is entitled to a vision, you know, free vision testing every 2 years, free hearing checks. So go and avail of them and help all your senses, because the more you help your senses, the more
stimulated your brain will be, I presume.
And also, even if your destiny is that you are developing dementia, the more you'll be able to compensate. Yes. Because if you can see properly and hear properly, you can compensate, whereas if they're also affected, you know, it's like a jet engine that's starting to lose different engines, it's eventually going to run into trouble.
You mentioned there, Suzanne, destiny, if that's your destiny to develop dementia, and obviously there are many non-modifiable risks. Would the take-home message from our conversation today be you will probably never eradicate your own risk of developing dementia if it's in your, if it's something that is destined to happen, but by being very proactive about your own health, by doing all the things that you've both outlined today, you can stave it off for a long, long time?
So I think some forms of dementia are totally preventable, you know, so I would say alcohol related, you know, Korsakoff's dementia is preventable. Certain infective causes of dementia are preventable. And vascular dementia, to a degree, is largely preventable. People who, you know, drink excessively and take crack cocaine, that's preventable dementia. So there are some that are totally related to lifestyle choices. But for a lot of us, it is a combination of subtle genetic predispositions or susceptibilities and lifestyle choices. And that's where we can change the odds and we can delay it. Even if we don't prevent it, if we can delay it, as I said, 5 or 10 years, that makes a difference. And in the meantime, you know, studies are ongoing to look at those proteins and to pick up early people who are starting to develop changes. And hopefully in 10 years and 20 years time, added to that, we'll be going in for treatments that will actually change our destiny. I think we're just not quite there yet in routine practice, but I think we won't be using that word destiny anymore. We'll be starting to say, well, actually, practically no one should be ultimately developing dementia.
And it's a chronic condition. It's a chronic disease. It's like diabetes, blood pressure, heart failure, all of those other COPD, all of those other chronic. People live with their dementia. What Suzanne and I and lots of other people try to do is make sure that dementia doesn't impact untowardly on their lives. And it's actually, so some of these things, all what we're talking about is if you push off the impact of dementia. So it's fine, you know, one thing having mild memory difficulties, it's a whole different thing when you have functional impairment or difficulty doing your day-to-day tasks as a result of it. So if you can push off by 2 or 3 years whereby you're having a functional impairment related to your memory difficulties, well, other things happen as we get older and other conditions kind of come into play. And it's likely that it may not be a significant factor in your life and you'll be able to successfully live with dementia. And that's what we're really trying to, and that's a large message in the Understand Together is that people live with this condition as they do with many other chronic disease conditions.
And I think it's so important for people, if they are worried about their memory, not to be afraid to get help. Your own GP is your first port of call. Go and chat about your memory. You know, particularly bring along a family member who can give that story, because a lot of it is that second story. Someone saying, well, actually, I've noticed this as well. And don't be afraid. There's lots we can do for people at the moment and lots of information. And then, you know, we are working within the National Dementia Office. I know Sean has talked about the lack of services. I agree, you know, there is inequitable service. The west of Ireland is not well serviced, but we are looking at that and we're mapping and we're analysing, we're building business cases, and that will too improve over time. The degree to which it improves and how quickly really depends on funding, I suppose, ultimately from the Department of Health and how it's used within the HSC. But things are improving all the time, and I wouldn't want anyone to think, well, I live in Mayo and therefore there's nothing for me. Things are improving, and when we look back in comparison to 5 or 10 years ago, services, they're growing, probably not quickly enough, but they are improving. And unless people go and present and say, I have trouble, services won't improve in their local area because it'll look as if there's no need. So, you know, go out and shake some trees, you know, look and demand your service, and that'll help us justify extra services.
That's all for the first episode of my Health Matters podcast. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. I hope you found it interesting and informative. And if you did, please share this podcast on your social media channels or rate us, or me really, on iTunes and subscribe. The next Health Matters podcast will be out in early October. Talk to you then.